The views expressed on the Final Straw Radio do not necessarily reflect those of Asheville FM, Friends of Community Radio, or any of the affiliate radio stations airing the show. Airing first on Asheville FM, WSFM LP at 103.3 FM in Asheville, North Carolina, this is The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough. The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can email us with questions, comments, or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. Also, if you're interested in rebroadcasting any episode or segment of the show, you're free to do so. Just send us an email if you end up using any content. If you care to, you can send us letters at our new address, which is The Final Straw Radio, P.O. Box 6004, Asheville, North Carolina, 28816. The show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee. Located at 610 Haywood Road, Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. You can find a sample of Firestorm's catalog of books and zines, plus a full calendar of events at their website, firestorm.coop. First up, we'll hear from Delee Nicol, a Wet'suwet'en community member from the Gidmatin clan of the Kasiuk House, a First Nation in so-called British Columbia, Canada. In 2009, Wet'suwet'en members of the Unist'ot'en clan, also of the Wet'suwet'en Nation, began actively blocking pipeline workers and government officials from accessing their land without prior and fully informed consent of the Nation of the Land. Over the years, Unist'ot'en has become home to various structures to not only block the passage of the pipeline, but also to create opportunities for Indigenous folks to heal themselves and promote their culture. On December 14th, the Canadian Supreme Court pushed through an injunction on behalf of Coastal GasLink, owned by TransCanada, threatening the Wet'suwet'en community defending its land at Unist'ot'en with police invasion. Following this, a pipeline statement was made by the five hereditary chiefs of the Wet'suwet'en for all of the clans to block pipelines on their land. The Wet'suwet'en people have no treaties with the Canadian or provincial government. Their land is unceded and sovereign territory within the bounds of what is claimed by Canada. According to United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, Article 10, quote, "Indigenous peoples shall not be forcibly removed from their lands or territories," end quote. This includes RCMP and or military removal of Indigenous peoples occupying their territory, say the land defenders. They also point out that the 1997 Supreme Court of Canada ruling in the Delgamuukw/Gisdaiwa Court case affirmed that the Wet'suwet'en title, based on the traditional clan governance system, was never extinguished. In the days since this interview was recorded, an update to the injunction by the Canadian Supreme Court was released that updated names and places to be targeted by police action. The chiefs were informed by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, or RCMP, which a Canadian federal police force, that their people and their spaces would likely be attacked by the RCMP in coming days to move forward on the building of the Coastal GasLink pipeline. The Wet'suwet'en resistance to the pipeline is asking for Native folks to come and help defend the land from further Canadian incursion, for allies and accomplices to engage in solidarity actions to pressure and embarrass the Canadian government and spread word of the resistance of Wet'suwet'en people on their sovereign lands in defense of the earth, air, and water that all of us share on this planet. Gidmatin Camp is calling on all people of conscience to act in solidarity through an International Day of Action on Tuesday, January 8th, 2019. You can inform yourself more by visiting wetsuweten.com, that's W-E-T-S-U-W-E-T-E-N, and keep up on updates via their Facebook page named Gidmatin Checkpoint Visit, Wet'suwet'en Access Point on Gidmatin Territory. There'll be more information, including an international call-out, in our show notes. And secondly, we are going to present an interview with JR, who is a member of the Submedia Collective, about their recent Trouble episode called Mad Worlds. Trouble is a monthly mini-documentary series from this collective which highlights different aspects of life and struggle on the far left. It's meant to be watched in groups to promote discussion and counter the increasing isolating aspects of modern-day existence. The episode Mad Worlds, Redefining Sanity Through Struggle, explores the concept of sanity and how this is intrinsically linked to the white hetero settler colonialist patriarchy, and also gets into the psychiatry industrial complex and what it could mean to be on either side of that structure. This is the first time that me and Bursts have interviewed someone together, so let us know what you think of that. To see more from Submedia, including It's the End of the World and We Know It and I Feel Fine, also called The Fucking Show, which features anarchist news analysis and reporting from the infamous character of The Stimulator. Also, they do a semi-regular anarchist and anti-fascist hip-hop workout show called Burning Cop Car, which we've drawn on multiple times for music to score the final straw, and, of course, Trouble, plus more. You can see all of that at sub.media. They are also in the middle of a fundraising push right now, and you can see info about that at sub.media/donate to liberate your dollars.
Finally, The Final Straw Radio is proud to be alongside its Going Down, Crime Think, and Mutual Aid Disaster Relief in calling for a week of action around the weekend of January 20, 2019. With the charges from 2017's anti-inauguration protest dropped, we can focus on other forms of long-term solidarity and mutual aid, creating a fertile soil for the future resistance and creativity. You can find the challenge and ways to plug in at cwc.im/survival.
Would you please introduce yourself for the listening audience?
Okay, my name is Dalee Nicol, and I am a Wet'suwet'en community member from the Get'em Den Clan and Kasiak House.
Can you talk a little bit about your people and your land?
Sure. We are, for the most part, located up in northwestern British Columbia. Our territory is very, very vast and very different, I guess, in terrain and usage of the land over the past centuries. Well, since time immemorial that we've used the land. We've relocated during seasonal shifts according to what we've needed over the years. So we haven't had necessarily a one set location that we've been in throughout the duration of our existence. We utilize the land according to season and according to need and also according to clan.
And what's your people's relationship with the Canadian state? Like, what sort of treaties do you have or not have, and like shared understandings or such?
We do not have any treaties in place. We have never had any treaties in place. We have never. We have all of our territories are unceded, and we have never come to an agreement of any sort in regards to surrendering our land or our rights.
So in 2009, the camp known as the Unistoten Camp was built, as I understand, in order to protect the earth, to also protect the indigenous sovereignty of the land they reside with from tar sands oil being brought across their property for export. Is that a correct understanding of...
As far as I know, yes, but I think that the portion and the idea of maintaining our sovereignty and none of those territories or lands ever being surrendered is extremely important, as well as protection of our traditional territories and earth in general.
So recently, I guess the Unistoten camp was built by other people from the Wet'suwet'en Nation in order to help defend the earth and retain the sovereignty, as you say. So can you talk a little bit about what changes have occurred or what steps forward the Canadian state has made in terms of trying to take the land or use the land without the agreement of Wet'suwet'en people?
I can't necessarily speak on the Unistoten and what they've been going through, but I can say that all of the hereditary chiefs within the Wet'suwet'en, within our clan system, have agreed and stood against industry and pipelines moving through our territories, and that was determined in our feast hall, which is our governance system, our hereditary governance system.
What is the next step with the agreement in that public forum to not allow the proceeding of those projects?
We have set up a checkpoint on Gidimden territory, which is not Unist'ot'en territory. It's a neighboring territory, and because our hereditary chiefs have firmly stated that there will be no pipelines going through or no access by anybody who is looking to trespass upon our territories, with the possibility of it leading to the destruction of our lands and our waterways and our earth in general. We have been given, I guess, all the chiefs have stood in solidarity and said that they stand behind us and we are within our right to have our checkpoint there and to make sure that we are determining who we are allowing onto our territory.
I've always been really fascinated by this as a method, since I've heard of it, denying access. There's a term that I've heard used before, the free and full consent. Is that what it is?
Free and prior informed consent.
Free and prior informed consent. Can you talk about free and prior informed consent and how that relates to access to your lands in this instance? Like who gets to come on, what the land gets used for, or what have you?
I wouldn't be able to speak fully on that because that would be determined within the feast hall.
Okay.
Yeah.
So with the decision that was made by the five hereditary chiefs in the feast hall, there was a determination, it sounds like, of not allowing Enbridge or TransCanada or whoever is trying to put the pipeline across the lands. At this point, is it correct in assuming that the Canadian government is directly doing the pushing to try to get these projects through, or is it still somewhat in the hands of the corporations?
It sounds like, well, just as, and this is solely from what I've seen on media or through media, via media, with Justin Trudeau saying that he will be pushing the pipelines or the pipelines will go through. It sounds that way, yes. It sounds like they will be pushing through regardless of the territories being unceded and us never having come to an agreement before.
So I've heard that the next 24 to 72 hours are potentially a time when you might be contacted by RCMP or the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. What are y'all expecting, and how that, as far as you can tell us, how are you preparing for a potential visit?
We have people out on our lands at the checkpoint and at just various camps, family members, elders, children, and they're utilizing the land. We have several workshops going on with use of our traditional territories, and we're out there, ensuring that we are protecting our lands and our territories. And as far as, any sort of infringement upon our right to utilize those lands, we have definitely asserted our right to utilize our territory and make sure that we're out there, we're visible. So we have people at the checkpoint. We don't know exactly what the next step for the Canadian government will be. Nobody has come to us and stated anything that is definitive. We are just making sure that our territory is utilized and protected right now, and that we do have people consistently out there.
Are there any instances of the Canadian government in recent documented history, of what it's likely to do or what it has done in instances where it comes into contact with sovereign people living in the territory that it claims, and how it might act?
I guess maybe not in, I guess I couldn't speak upon recent history, but in cases within the past where sovereign nations have stood up for their territories and their rights, the Canadian government has violated the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples by forcing or by coming in and using force against Indigenous peoples with the RCMP, I would like to think that wouldn't be the case, but history has shown that there has been a pretty consistent course of action that states that the colonial or Canadian government has not recognized Indigenous rights within Canada, which I think is extremely unfortunate, considering there's so much talk about reconciliation and that the colonial or Canadian government has stated that they will start recognizing UNDRIP. So it's quite contradictory, the actions that could come about, and the words that they've spoken in the recent past.
So the injunction that was delivered in December seemed to have been against Unistoten in terms of allowing access to Coastal GasLink. Has the RCMP made any similar injunctions against y'all or any other Wet'suwet'en people in terms of allowing access?
No, we have not been contacted nor presented with any sort of injunction. The Gitumden clan has not. But everybody at the second checkpoint has not been privy to that information. That is specifically against the Unistoten, as far as I've been informed. And that's a completely separate case.
What sort of support are y'all seeking at this point? Are you asking for people to come up and stand with you at the points of blockade, or material support from a distance, or solidarity actions outside of your territory, or what?
All of those would be incredibly appreciated. Definitely, I believe that anybody that is involved at all with human rights organizations, anybody that is aware and informed that we are sovereign nations, it would be most appreciated if we did have frontline support from Indigenous peoples in general. And if we are looking for solidarity actions, calling upon governments, or government, smaller government structures, your MLAs, MPs, contacting, like I said, human rights organizations and requesting that they stand by us, and ensuring, I guess, that this remains a safe issue and is recognized as a human rights issue.
Can you talk about how y'all's decision to defend the land from this, there's the immediate threat, right, of if a pipeline or if there was a transit means across your territory of compressed natural gas or of unrefined tar sands or whatever, it seems like that would pose a threat to your life ways and to the other animals that share your territory and the plants, right?
Yeah. I think that it becomes a larger picture than that. Not only would our rights be infringed upon, our natural areas and natural habitats, our the wildlife systems, the ecosystems will all be adversely affected, as well as our communities. We actually have one of the people out at camp who's quite involved has done studies before on effects, and they've always turned out to be adverse effects from industry, large amounts of industry coming through small indigenous communities and territories. And we are on the Highway of Tears, and so having a large amount of transient workers coming in, we would face the effects of higher crime rates, that's been studied and proven. We would face larger numbers of violence against Indigenous peoples, primarily Indigenous women, and we don't want any of that. We want to make sure that we are keeping our people safe and our community members safe, and generally the community surrounding us at large. We would like to ensure that we remain healthy and functional.
Last year, last week on the show, we were lucky enough to interview some folks doing support for resistors to the Dakota Access Pipeline. There were five people in particular who caught federal charges in the U.S. Who are all indigenous, mm-hmm. For helping to block that for a while, very bravely. Can you talk a little bit about the wider implications in terms of solidarity with life outside of your own clan group, in that is represented in blockading this sort of transport of dangerous chemicals that could affect the environment at a global scale?
Well, yeah, I believe that there are cleaner energy sources out there, and the easier that it is presented that we can push these through, the less likely it is that we are going to be looking at more sustainable and eco-friendly energy sources. It also sets a precedent for various, Indigenous communities across North America, across Turtle Island. This isn't just for us. We are doing this for our people as a whole.
Popular media in the United States has a pretty banal understanding, I think, pretty frequently of the goings on in so-called Canada. And there's a lot of liberals that have some very positive viewpoints of Justin Trudeau. He hasn't been in office for really all that long yet, but can you talk a little bit about your understanding of his track record in terms of protecting the environment or respecting First Nations?
Well, we can look at the fact that his father wrote the white paper, and it's all been about a forced assimilation. If we track as far back as his father, who was a prime minister in previous years. As far as Justin Trudeau goes, as far as he stands, I mean, his statement saying that he would be pushing through the pipelines, and that he invested billions of dollars in ensuring that happens, states everything there is to say about where he stands on actually respecting Indigenous rights and Indigenous communities, which is that he doesn't.
Yeah. Are there any major points that I didn't hit, or any things that you want to touch on besides where people can continue to, well, where people can make donations and where people can find out more information? And
we do have a GoFundMe page. So that would be the Wet'suwet'en access point on Gidimden territory. And we also have a Facebook page, which we will be regularly updating. On the page, we do have a list of supplies that is frequently needed. And we'll have the link for the GoFundMe on there. We have a couple of different lists out that will state solidarity actions that we would like people to be able to do if they can. Some of them will be direct actions. If Indigenous people are, and we would like to get more Indigenous people out to our camp, out to the checkpoint, to share our culture. I mean, we've had a very long history of working with other Indigenous communities and standing and supporting them, and we'd like to continue that by bringing people out. I do believe that there will be, as well, possibly an Amazon wish list. So if people want to go on there, I think we will be setting that up most likely today. But all of the links can be found on the Facebook page for now. And then the website is in the process of being built. So it will be able to, I believe it'll have links for more concise forms of support, allyship, and action.
Thank you so much. Is there anything that we didn't get to that you'd like to express?
I'd like to express my gratitude and the gratitude from all the people at the checkpoint for people recognizing and standing up for us during this time, as well as the people that have dedicated their time and energy to spreading the word on this. And I think that it just needs to be recognized that it is quite an urgent situation, and it might not be optimal weather conditions for a lot of people, but we do have people that are out there, and it's greatly appreciated when people can come out or when people do contact us and let us know what they've been doing to help support. So I am grateful for that.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for making this conversation happen, and
thank you. Good luck
and solidarity.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Here's a jingle from another member of CZN.
You're listening to Dissident Island Radio.
Live every first and third Friday of the month at 9 p.m. GMT.
Check out www.dissidentisland.org for downloads and more.
Teamwork.
Excellent. So thank you so much for coming on to the show with us. Would you introduce yourself if you would like to and talk a little bit about what you do?
Yeah, my name is JR, and I guess introduction would be I've been a crazy person my whole life. I've been an anarchist for a little over a decade, and I've been the part of the Submedia Collective for a little over a year now. And yeah, so that's kind of what I do.
So we're actually here to talk about the recent Trouble episode from Submedia that you worked on called Mad Worlds. Will you begin by describing the Trouble series and what its aims are?
For sure. So the Trouble series is basically monthly mini documentaries, for lack of a better title. And they're basically 30-minute mini docs that kind of our aim is to address mostly like people who already consider themselves to be anarchists or part of radical or militant communities, and And we want our documentaries to really promote discussion amongst those communities and bring up topics that we think are important and frame a little bit of our analysis, or at least the analysis that we cobble together with their views on these topics. Yep.
Cool. One thing that I really like about the Trouble series is it's collective nature of it's the intention behind it is for people to come together and have a space for collective analysis. Would you talk about that aspect a little bit of the Trouble series?
Yeah. So each episode basically, with each episode, we include a screening kit, which is kind of like a list of questions and resources that we think are a good follow-up to the content that we put out in the Trouble episode. And then our little pitch at the end of every show is, just a reminder, Trouble is intended to be watched in groups and to promote discussion on these topics. So really kind of the way that we, measure success and our goals as an organization or as a crew is really to, get people out there, get people engaged, and hopefully get some people who might otherwise just, stay in and watch Netflix out making trouble and pissing off the powers of bee. So
I was going to ask if you all get very much feedback from the viewers. Our ABC chapter in town, actually right after this interview, I'm going to go fill in the time slot that would be Trouble showing. We do it the first Friday of the month at the Anarchist Bookstore in town, but this month, since there's no episode, we're watching one of the documentaries about Nazis from PBS. Woo, Adam Woffen. But do you get much feedback about how those public showings go, or what kind of discussions happen?
I mean, we do. We get feedback. Sometimes it's a little hit or miss just because a lot of people, some viewers might not feel super excited about broadly announcing their event.
Mm.
But we do. Yeah, we hear awesome stories. There was the screening of our gentrification episode in Prague that ended up, I don't know exactly how it went down, but it kind of turned into the cops tried to raid the screening and then the neighborhood came out and defended it. So.
Oh, that's fucking awesome.
You mean the episode entitled Defend the Block?
Mm-hmm, yep.
Awesome.
That's the story, at least.
That's so cool.
I'll believe that. So Mad Worlds is an episode that deals with the mental health industrial complex and how mental wellness issues impact more marginalized people and radical communities. Will you describe the thinking that went into making this episode?
Yeah, for sure. When I joined the collective a little over a year ago, one of the first kind of brainstorming sessions that we had for future episodes, I think I might have still been an intern at that point. I was just I think we should talk about mental health. I think it's something that is hugely present in anarchist scenes, definitely in my life and the scenes that I'm part of. Mm-hmm. And I think that the kind of conversations around it are either non-existent amongst the left, or when they do happen, they can be a little bit I don't want to say tokenizing, but almost sort of paying lip service to we know, but sort of similar to physical ableism conversations. Mm-hmm. It's you need an analysis, but the actual discourse is usually woefully inadequate. So anyway, so I brought this up and the rest of the collective was yeah, that's a great idea. And then, yeah, we we chose the topic and we reached out and found some great interviews and made it happen.
In my just like informal opinion or like informal analysis, the topic of mental health has been becoming a little bit more visible. Do you agree with that? And if so, what do you think is going on there? And if not, like what can people do to like make it a bit more visible?
Yeah. So I guess it really depends on which crew of people you're talking about. Mm-hmm. I think in what I would imperfectly call like quote mainstream society, there is this like mental health advocacy kind of discourse that's like growing. Like people are sort of talking about like, I don't know if I should say like, people are kind of talking about like things like depression and suicidality and like, and there's sort of this like, let's talk about it message. Let's like destigmatize mental health. And I think that at least in mainstream society, you could say that that's better than nothing, but it's pretty close to nothing because these discourses completely overlook the underlying social and societal factors behind mental health. And it's really just sort of like, maybe it's better than nothing, but it feels pretty small. And then, as far as like in the communities that I'm part of that I feel like affinity with, like my circle of friends and comrades and et cetera, like, yeah, we talk about mental health, but it's really in these like informal sort of like friend check-ins, like, hey, how you doing? Like, you know, so I don't know if, maybe the way that mental health is being talked about is more common. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah, and you mentioned the like parallel between how physical disabilities are talked about, and you mentioned that being like kind of like a lip service sort of model of solidarity or something like that, and I definitely agree with that based on my own observations of like rad scenes. Thanks for going into that.
JR, could you talk about concepts of normalcy and how that overlaps with supremacist, settler colonial, and ableist ideology and the liberatory perspective that mad anarchist viewpoints can give? I've used perspectives twice in that sentence, damn it.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. It's a huge question, the scope of it. I'll try and do my best. For me, the way that I think that psychiatrists talk about normal, it's basically the same way that your teachers talked about normal. It's the same normal that a judge thinks of, like when you, if you ever find yourself in court. And basically, it's just these like layers of, I would say, like tropes or like cliches about what sets of behaviors and what things are part of like an acceptable life. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, so for sure, like in the context of like colonialism and white supremacy, like your best way at fitting into normals, at least in the part of the world that I'm in, is to be white, to be heterosexual, to be gainfully employed. And so like, that's sort of like this idea that like, if you are those things, then, you know, this isn't new stuff. This is like, if you occupy those categories, you are privileged. If you're not those categories, like, for example, if you're like a newcomer or like an immigrant, and then the trope that applies to you is like, well, you better be that like hardworking, pull yourself up by the bootstraps sort of, person, and so on and so on. And so basically, in the context of mental health, what that means for people is when they are seen by a psychiatrist, or if they're more unfortunate, by the judges and prison guards, then the things that like gain you reprieve and like show that you're making progress in air quotes, or like doing well, those are all things like how well you're holding down a job, like if you're in a nice heterosexual relationship, like, and so on and so on. Yeah. So then I guess to then like extrapolate from that, the amazing liberatory message that anarchism can provide and anarchist analysis can provide is like, hey, you know, like maybe you haven't been feeling well, maybe you haven't been doing well in life, but like you get to pick your identity, and like you get to pick, well, you don't get to pick every aspect, but like you get to pick your values. You get to decide if for you normal is actually subverting the status quo, or being like, you know, going and riding trains around the country. Like you can decide what wellness is for you, and that doesn't have to come from these series of cultural whatever cliches and tropes that are, yeah, obviously super unattainable for almost everyone.
Maybe like going to talk a little bit more about the episode gives space to anti-medication perspectives like those voiced by the Icarus Project, but also gives space to respect people's choice to engage with medication while seeking wellness. There's similar things expressed by Mango in the episode around confinement during troubled times. Can you talk about walking that line while producing this documentary between critiquing systems while respecting individuals' needs?
Mm-hmm, for sure. So to get super personal, like that is a line that I walk every day. I'm somebody who has been institutionalized in the past in psych wards. I've had like periods of my life where I just completely lose touch with who I am and what's important to me. And actually, there's no story of me and who I am that doesn't include these like hugely coercive and problematic institutions, but still that was my path out of crisis. And so I'm someone whose life has literally been saved by modern psychiatry. And I also am intimately connected to people who have almost had their lives destroyed by modern psychiatry, and have like been in community with people who have been murdered by the police for being crazy. And so, I mean, I think if we were to sort of not give that nuanced perspective and only come out as anti-psychiatry, or not give space for the stories of people who take medication, well, first of all, it would be incredibly disingenuous of me as somebody who does like take medication every day. But it also, I think, would just alienate so many people who, we're kind of hoping to reach and give this analysis to.
Yeah, and that was something about the episode that really resonated with me as well, as somebody who also takes medication in order to stay afloat. I was like really touched and impressed by that. And I think it's like a super important tension to acknowledge the like realities of like people experiencing mental distress, and like the tools that we have generally at our disposal are the product of like so many things that we like despise, you know, or, you know, stuff like that. So like, yeah, thanks for like holding space for that in the documentary too. That was really,
yeah,
really
sure.
Important.
I mean, like, it's, there's a point to be made too, that it's like, there's so many things that we do in the imperfect way that the world is, you know, like there's so many things that aren't ideal about like the food we eat and the cars that we drive and like all of these choices that we make in order to survive in the context that we live in. And so, yeah, having space for nuance is like hugely important.
And also, I'm sorry that I'm kind of monopolizing this, but like, also the imperfection sort of, the idea of like living in an imperfect world, and also like that sort of leaves, a little bit of troubling of the notion of perfection, and how sort of unattainable that is, and sort of where does the notion of perfection come from, and like, oh, if I, like, just move towns, I'll find, like, a perfect life. Or if I, you know, do something else, then everything will be perfect. And how sort of, like, how much of a, like, golden cage that is, thinking-wise, or whatever.
It's sort of like substituting one set of idealized tropes for another, you know? Instead of the state being like, oh, yeah, unless you're a perfect, like, cog in the functioning of capitalism, you know, you're not perfect, but then why would we replace that with, unless you're some, you know, pure ninth level consumer, conscious consumer, whatever it would be.
Definitely.
I didn't even know there was a ninth level. I thought it stopped at seven. Damn it.
There's always room for improvement,
Burst. Set my sights higher. Is there anything that you wanted to include in the film, like any perspectives or voices that you weren't able to, like whether because of length or because you couldn't get a hold of the person that you really wanted to hear from? And if so, what or who would you have liked to have included?
The thing that stands out the most, if you're familiar with the series, the Trouble series, we usually end every episode with what we call like the lessons segment. And so it's basically where the interviewees on whatever topic sort of, we just say like, what lessons would you want to pass forward? Like what things have you learned that you would want other people to know about? And I mean, the people that we interviewed for this episode have like some amazing experience and are doing really rad projects, but I definitely felt like a little bit like the lessons weren't there as strongly as I was hoping. And maybe it was like a naive thing because, you know, mental health is such a like complex and like overwhelmingly difficult to crack phenomenon. But like, I it's possible that we'll do a follow-up in the months to come on mental health that focuses more on what people are doing to I guess like sort of provide steps forward.
One topic that I really hope to like go into a little bit more with either like here, I don't know if we have time now, but in future interviews is the intersection between, or the like parallel between survivors of like the psychiatry industrial complex who are like, you know, and radical politics. I just think there's like, I think part of the strengths of like leaving a lesson segment sort of open to interpretation is that like acknowledging the fact that there's so much more room for us to grow in this topic. And, cause I think that this topic is something that has been traditionally silenced or traditionally just like, you know, sequestered away. And the analyses and the like really important sort of thinking that goes into visibilizing this topic is, I think, really important to like a radical analysis. So, I don't know if you have any, like, words on trajectories that you see part two going. Do you have any ideas about that?
Well, with regards to the intersections between psychiatry survivors and radical politics, for lack of a better way of talking about it, is I don't know. Like, I've read some of the Mad in America guy puts forward, and then also some of the feedback that we got from the episode from people that are embedded. There was one person who works doing peer support, like peer crisis support for people who are having severe mental health issues. This person is someone who goes in and just kind of helps out how they can. And they responded to the episode just being like, this is like amazing. And it like confirms all of these things and the, like the intersectionality inherent in mental health and all of these other things. And so, yeah, for sure. Like there's been people getting really excited about it who have, people getting excited about the sort of progressive messages who haven't been as exposed to those in the past and have more been embedded in more just focused on mental health issues. So I know some of that's happened already. As far as the trajectory of the follow-up episode, I guess I would really just try to focus on maybe giving viewers a little bit more as far as like what to do and where to go. Like we had some things in the show notes, like Sasha is part of this crew that put together this thing called P-Maps, which is maps to the other side. And it's just ways of like charting your own health. And I think that's like a really awesome resource. So really just trying to like I don't know, maybe it's just me that felt this way and a few people have said they felt the same, but like I just felt a little bit stuck at the end of the episode, like, oh man.
I can only imagine that you'd feel that way just because it's such a huge topic. But maybe I'd love to know if you were, in the making of this documentary, if you were surprised by anything.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, just to segue right off that thing of like felt a little bit stuck, there was this amazing thing that happened to me as I was making the episode. And all of the interview footage had just come in and I was doing the logging or the editing, and I was doing my own interview and just like looking at it. And I just had this like, I don't know, like thinking about and talking about and focusing on mental health really intensively. It was kind of like taking a toll. And then I watched my interview and I just felt so like disheartened and like, and not only that, but I felt like my own analysis on mental health was really just like bad politics or something. Like, and so I was actually like on the verge of like writing to the crew and being like, y'all, I'm like feeling massively overwhelmed and need to like take a big step back. And I pushed through and was like, I'm just going to log a few more interviews before I like make that decision. And it was just like a combination of really all of the rest of the interviewees like watching their answers, and I was just like, yeah, just felt like really optimistic and really like people who like, I mean, most of my own way of like coping with my experiences is to like not think about them and not talk about them most of the time. And so then seeing these like awesome people who are sort of embedded in like frontline mental health support. Yeah, it was really rejuvenating and it was surprising. I was surprised to feel optimistic. So when I say that at the end of the episode, I felt a little bit disheartened, it's only compared to the like overwhelming great feelings around this episode and the great response too that we've been getting. So
that's fantastic.
Besides another episode kind of following up on this topic of mental wellness, are there any other upcoming episodes of Trouble that you'd like to clue us in on, and when does the next series start up?
We're going to be working on one for the end of February. So it's not the end of January, is it? Oh man, I don't know. I'm the worst. I'm on holidays right now, so yeah. So, but we're going to get right back into it and release one. I think it's at the end of February, if not this month. And so, yeah, if you want a sneak peek on what we've been thinking about, our next episode is going to be on, I guess you could call it like community responses to policing. And then we also are looking at doing one on technology, one on prison, a fun one that'll be, one on war. And then we're thinking of doing one on climate and potentially on violence in general, although that might get wrapped up into the war episode.
That's cool.
Yeah, so
yeah, a bucket full of rainbows right there.
Bucket full of rainbows. The happy 2019 Trouble, yeah. and then we're breaking it up. Oh, I guess, yeah.
So, Submedia has a fundraiser coming up. Do you want to talk about that at all? And is this to bring back STEM?
Yeah, so we do an annual fundraiser so that we can, you know, STEM can buy his tacos and we can pay our rent. And so we do have a return planned for STEM. It's going to be a little bit bigger in scope than what you're used to, and it should be dropping around summertime, and that'll be what I'll say about that.
I'm imagining a corporeal like STEM. Like STEM is actually going to be brought into physical existence and set down in the streets of, I don't know, Hamilton or Vancouver or some exciting destination.
Or it'll be STEM plus gritty.
Oh.
3D print your own model. Yeah.
There'll be no more world left. Excellent.
Well, that's great. Thank you so much for taking the time to have this chat.
That was great. Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I got a lot out of talking to you and a lot out of the episode, too. So I guess, keep up the really awesome work, and look forward to more episodes of Trouble in future.
Awesome.
Yeah.
If you care to support The Final Straw Radio, please consider a one-time donation via our PayPal, or a recurring donation via our Patreon or LibrePay. We have items on the Patreon and in our Big Cartel web store to thank supporters, including stickers, buttons, t-shirts, and zines. Great timing for the socially required gift-giving holiday season. We never charge for our audio work, so if you feel like you can kick something back cash-wise our way, we really appreciate it. Find out more at our website.
Airing first on Asheville FM, WSFM-LP at 103.3 FM in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough. The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can email us with questions, comments, or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. Also, if you're interested in rebroadcasting any episode or segment of the show, you're free to do so. Just send us an email if you end up using any content. If you care to, you can send us letters at our new address, which is The Final Straw Radio, P.O. Box 6004, Asheville, North Carolina 28816. The show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee. Located at 610 Haywood Road, Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. You can find a sample of Firestorm's catalog of books and zines, plus a full calendar of events at their website, firestorm.coop.